Okay, well, thank you for the introduction. And I just wanted to point out about Ciela. You mentioned it in passing. It's a new institute in Montreal from UdaM, but it's a separate institute. It's been like a year that it's around. So one of the faculties is the Acharya Saavedra that I'm working with there. And there's like involvement from people from Mila, like Joshua Benjo and so on. So that's, it's a very new place, very nice place to do cool research. And so let's get started. I know that there's like a bunch of people who know astronomy very well. And there's a bunch of people who know causality very well. So you will be sleeping probably like half of the time. And to facilitate this, I was like, I wanted to show like these cats. So when the white cat appears, it means that you probably can fall asleep if you know astronomy. And when the black cat appears, it's like for the machine learning or statistical people who, you know, they can take a rest. No cats, please pay attention, okay? So to start from the start, those who do astronomy like know a lot about its limits, right? And one of the limits we don't talk about very much, but it's there, is that astronomy is an observational science. So usually I cannot go there and like change the mass of Jupiter to cite an idea that we had yesterday at lunch. What you can do at most in the solar system is like throw a big, something like the size of a refrigerator into a comet and see what happens. They did this in 2005. But of course, it's not like really the kind of broad scope of intervention that we have in a lab on the ground here. And if you look at stuff that is further away, like supernovae and stuff, you will see that there are even more constraints. You cannot like blow up a supernova in a galaxy far away, right? So observational science means many things to many people. There's lots of observational sciences, like economics to a point is observational, sociology, and epidemiology and so on. You don't go and infect people with COVID or something, right? So in observational science, we cannot make experiments. And some other things are true, well, depending on the science. Like they're true for astronomy. Like we are part of this history that starts with the Big Bang and then the enrichment of gas by the first stars and this kind of stuff. And we cannot do much to change that. We can imagine it differently, but that's it. It's the way it is, right? And we look at stuff from a fixed vantage point. Like, you've ever wondered, like, when you sit in a chair and you look at the table, if the other side of the table exists? So, like, it's very convenient in, like, in your house that you can walk around the table and check. Like, you look at it, oh, it's there. Well, of course, then you will have doubts about the other side that you don't see anymore. But you cannot do this in astronomy. Like, so we don't know, like, what's on the other side of, well, even the moon before we sent somebody there, right? Well, a probe around it. So we have a fixed vantage point. And finally, well, we are part of the system under study. So if we are here and we see something, it could be because the thing not being there or being different could have killed us. So these are quite big limitations. But after all, they're not that bad because we have no choice. So experiments are confined in time and space. So this is the longest running experiment in Australia. It's been running for 97 years old. They're like looking at a pitch drop from a funnel. And like a drop comes down every like 9 years or something like that. It's very viscous fluid. So we cannot experiment on much longer time scales or much bigger spatial scales. And it's not something we can choose. So you could say that any science that wants to be general enough, it must become observational at some point because it goes outside of the scope of what can be done experimentally, right? Great. So, but what is so hot about experiments? Like, why are people like into experiments so much? Why do we care about experiments as physicists? And why do we feel sad that we cannot do those in astronomy? The main reason is that interventions, so something that you can do without, not without a reason, but without too many environmental constraints. So you wake up and you say, I want to measure the mass of the electron. And no one forced you to do that, right? So this is anthropomorphic, but that there's this feeling that your action of measuring or doing something has no causal parents. And we even engineer this in randomized controlled trials. So here I'm using the word experimenting in a very loose way. So I'm putting together like tests for medicines in hospitals together with Yale HCs. It's very different stuff. But at any rate, in a randomized controlled trial, you have a random number generator that is like telling you, I'm treating this person and I'm not treating this other person. This breaks any dependence and manipulates one variable at a time without having a whole chain of causal connections determining that you end up doing this thing or that one. And that's what's valuable about experiments. They let us know the causal structure of our variables throughout the experiment because we can manipulate them one by one and see what happens when we touch that one only. But we're in astronomy. So like the economists, like the epidemiologists and other people, we are constrained. We cannot do this thing always well or well. And so we need something to reconstruct the causal structure just from observations. So typically you have a bunch of variables. You have a joint distribution of these variables, but it's given like per samples. So you sample from it because you have finite data. This is very important. And you want to come up with something that usually is represented like this as a DAG, meaning that, for instance, here there's an arrow going from X to Y, saying that X causes Y, which means that the probability distribution factorizes in a certain way. So it's going to be probability of X times probability of Y given X, right? So, but this is just like some notation. I'll go into this better later. How to do this? Well, there are a bunch of ways to do this thing, but what we start with when we're doing like observational science is like just correlations, right? So, and it's been known for a while that correlation doesn't mean causation. But if I ask you why, is there anyone who wants to answer this question? Why doesn't correlation always mean causation?
Could be a common cause.
Yeah. So that's an idea, right? So there are reasons why this doesn't like hold all the time. And if we get hold of those reasons, we can use them to our advantage. And there are different ways to do this. So repeating that, like what we see in the sky is a correlation. Like we always see that the position of this star does this thing over time, or the color does this thing as a function of the mass or whatever. So, and we don't know much more than that. From that, we have to bootstrap ourselves into causal understanding. So one way that's been around for about four centuries, and probably more if you go back to the Hellenistic times, I guess, is to like come up with models, theories. Right, and in the theory, you put in like your causal assumptions, ideas, and stuff in a way that's like up to you, as long as the theory then recovers the observed phenomena, which are the correlations you're looking at. And the second way, which is very popular among economists, is to look for experiments that happen in nature naturally, so natural experiments. And the third one is the one I will be talking about later. So number three will surprise you, well, half of you. So here is a good time to introduce some collaborators that are working on this project. These are people from New York University, Abu Dhabi, NYUAD. I've been there like last month. It's very nice. And there's a group doing simulations of galaxy formation. A zoom-in simulation. So essentially you take a cosmological simulation, which you would run with particles that have a given size because you cannot go too fine in resolution. It's too expensive, right? You're simulating a whole box. And then like you choose a galaxy that forms over there and you re-simulate everything with smaller particles in that galaxy, like keeping the big particles around in the rest of the universe. And that gives you a so-called zoom-in simulation. So, and among these people, there's also like a person who's been working on observational scaling relations, Benjamin Davis. And well, the idea is these guys are good at this, like making numerical models, right? and trying to do number one. And all of us are. Like, I guess everyone who's doing like cosmology, like, or galaxy formation or this kind of stuff, even planetary formation, is making numerical models by now and trying to reproduce observed correlations. So we know this thing. Yeah, great. Number two is already more different than what physicists do usually. And usually, like, we're not really doing it, like, but other people are doing it. So here, for instance, like, this is, properly speaking, causal inference. So it's a situation where you know what sort of what the causal structure is. So you know, like, that some variable is supposed to cause some other variable. And you want to know how much. You want to figure out the like details of that causal interaction. It's not causal discovery where you're like trying to come up with the causal structure from a bunch of variables. And well, the cool thing is that sometimes nature does experiments, or society does experiments, right? By experiments, I mean it treats some units and not some others. And it can do it at random if we're lucky. The problem with this for astronomers is that, unlike the state that sometimes like gives out like scholarships at random or stuff like that, so that's easy for the economists to find this stuff. Where does the sky do random number generation? Well, there is one scheme for doing this that's called regression discontinuity. It's pretty cool because it's a very smart idea where you're using the least significant digits of a number as a random number generator. So, like, if I ask you like how long this table is, you can probably tell me it's a meter and a half if you use like SI units or what, something like that. And the manufacturer of the table went like to great pain to ensure that it's like that within a millimeter, because otherwise it doesn't fit in the truck or something. But below the millimeter, it's random. Like, maybe the humidity of the air or other stuff determines how long it really is if you measure it down to the micrometer. So the idea is that, like, if you have some variable, like the length of the table, that determines treatment. So some other variable, which is binary, it gives you like a kick or not. And we want to see the effect of that variable. But the assignment to treatment, like the fact that you get that treatment, depends on the exact value of the length of the table, so of this underlying variable, passing a threshold. Then those that are really near the threshold pass or not, depending on these least significant digits. And that means that they pass or not at random. So they get the treatment or not at random. That's the idea behind this. This is applied in economics. Probably every third paper in economics is doing this. Like, they find a river or something, and north of the river and south of the river, they look at the villages and they check and they say, well, the climate is the same because the river like is in between, but nothing else. The people speak the same language, whatever. So you're controlling for all things because it's like nearby, but they've been assigned to, I don't know, a tax regime or something based on being north or south of the river. Doing this in the sky, well, two examples. And these are like mine, because it doesn't seem that the astronomers are really picking up on this thing. I didn't advertise it enough, probably. Or maybe there are reasons. We will come to that, because I think there are reasons. So there is a relatively recent paper where we're looking at a supernova shell. So supernovae are like stellar explosions, right? They shock the gas, and the shock expands. Like, you can work out like a thing called the Seydow solution, which tells you like how it's going over time. And on this side or on that side of the shock, are the properties of stars that we see different? If they are, and you think in terms of regression discontinuity, then, well, you could say that you're seeing the causal effect of the supernova shock on the stars, on the properties of the stars. This could be a trivial effect, like having dust in the middle that makes you estimate the mass differently. But it was a proof of concept. And another one, like previous one, 2019, is like we have This is the galaxy, our galaxy. It has a disk, right? And there's things called open clusters. So there are some open clusters moving towards the disk and some open clusters moving away from the disk. So you can't measure their velocities and positions with Gaia, the Gaia satellite. So you can calculate something like the Z coordinate divided by the velocity. And this is going to be your variable. And these are the treated guys, and these are the untreated guys. So those that just crossed the disk and those that didn't cross the disk yet. And you can compare stuff like the radius of the star cluster. And it turns out that we find that significantly in a subclass of star clusters, the radii of those that just crossed are bigger. And this is compatible with the ideas on dynamical heating. Except for these two exercises, there's like crickets. Like there's nothing, right, in astronomy. So I don't know.
So but, is there some kind of control sample for which this effect should not happen, and then you verify that it doesn't happen? You know, so things like globular clusters, for example, you know, do you find that this is?
Yeah, so this thing like is a research note, and you can look it up, but yes, it's true. Like what you ask is exactly what is happening, because the effect depends on velocity. If you're slow when you cross the disk, you feel the heat more. So if you look at two groups, one that is slow and one that is fast, the fast group doesn't really feel anything, and the slow group does. So that's pretty cool. But I never bothered like actually publishing like in a refereed journal because I was like, okay, this is so weird, nobody will care about it. Like, it's there, okay. And in fact, nobody cared about it. Okay, so let's come to the next thing. Limitations of this approach. So limitations of this approach are all over the place. Like you're forced to make lemonade with the lemons that nature gives you. So in this case, like you can think, okay, they're crossing the disk, whatever, like, and you're lucky that nature is giving you this natural experiment. But if you want to know something else, well, you don't, like, you have to wait for the right natural experiment. And that is gonna tell you something only about like two variables, right? This one and that one. The one that you threshold on, that they call the score, they are the economists, and the outcome. But maybe you want to do better than that, right? So number three comes in. It's called causal discovery. So the it's very, very broad field. I cannot possibly like summarize it here, but many of you know probably more than me about this, so that's good. It's been around since the mid 90s. And you probably heard of Judea Pearl. It's like, pretty famous guy who got the Turing Prize in 2017, I guess. I don't know, at some point. For this, among other things. So, and there's like here, there's references if you want to read about this. So the book by Pearl, Causality. And then there is another book by this guy called Spirtes, not Sprite. So I and R are in the right order here. Make sure. and there's these great lectures if you want to take a look at that on causal inference from a guy at Mila. So, but the goal is basically that you're given these variables, you measure them, you have a finite sample, and you want to come up with something that looks like that. So A causes B, C causes B, but B does not cause the other two, something like that. And we encode it in a thing called the DAG, directed acyclic graph. So it's a graph connecting the variable. The variables are nodes. The edges are arrows. That's why it's directed. And acyclic because, well, we will come to that. We don't want cycles here. Okay. Some people don't want cycles here. So there are different ways to do causal discovery. I think the cats are working because I see.
Is it causal?
Yeah. But there are many ways, but these are the two main ways. Like a thing called constraint-based causal discovery and another thing called score-based causal discovery. So constraint-based leverages the fact that there are patterns of independence between, or statistical independence between variables. that you must be able to observe to validate a certain causal structure. So for instance, if, like we were saying before, two things correlate, well, something is up. If they don't correlate, by correlate, correlate means linear stuff, but I'm saying it loosely to mean like any kind of association. If two things correlate, well, under certain assumptions that we will see, the other should be causing each other, A causes B or B causes A, or there should be something else, a third thing that causes both. And this is called the Reichenbach principle. It predates the whole story of causal discovery. It's from the 60s. And, well, it's an interesting thing. So if you leverage this, you can come up with essentially operational definitions of cause, which is what we need, like, because we're physicists, right? We want to know what to do to be able to claim that this causes that. And then you have score-based models, there are also score-based models, but they're different things. Score-based causal discovery, which is, the idea is like, in a sense, simpler because it's like brute forcing in a sense, in a way. So you're taking all possible DAGs, all possible causal structures, and each of them has some implied distribution for your variables once you have the right hypothesis on it. And you're evaluating them according to some criteria to say which one fits the data best. So constraint-based, I'll try to go a bit faster here. So maybe I'll skip something, but it typically rests on these two things, the causal Markov assumption and the faithfulness assumption. So the idea is that you have a bunch of variables. You assume that if I am a variable and you are controlling for my causal parents, my direct causes, then I'm going to be independent, conditional on those causes, on anything else except my effects, okay? This seems simple, like said like this, but it's very powerful. And then you have this faithfulness assumption that says something, the converse of this sort of, like it's saying, if you don't see an independence, it's not by chance. It's not that, like, essentially, the relations, if there is an independence relation, is because these things don't have to do with each other, like, causally, okay? And then you can or cannot assume that you're observing all the variables that matter for your problem. So that's called causal sufficiency if you assume that you do observe them all. Let's do a three-variable example that lets us reason through this and see some features of this thing. So you have three variables, right? A, B, C. So you have this little matrix on the right that tells you whether you can have an edge between A, B, or C. Like if you put a 1 there between A and B, then it means that there is a directed edge from A to B. And first of all, we don't want like to say that A causes itself. So the diagonal is empty. And also we want to exclude loops. So for the same reason, like because of like certain theorems don't hold anymore if you don't exclude loops. So you don't want A causing B and B causing C and C causing A. So if you do these restrictions, you go with these restrictions, you're left with like 25 DAGs for these variables that are just three. So this tells us something very cool not very cool, actually, very scary. If you increase the number of variables, the number of possible DAGs explodes. So we are at 25 already with three variables, right? And well, let's say that these are all the possible causal structures that you have given three variables. Now you observe something, one of those lacks of correlation. For instance, A and C are unconditionally independent. So it means that you're just looking, you're plotting A against C. If you do, you can do a test, a statistical test, for instance. So like that's the problem. Like you have finite data, right? So when you have finite data, the best you can do to figure out whether something is dependent on something else is, some people argue it's looking at the data. But let's say that you have A and B. and you have some points. If you look at this, you can think, well, it looks like they depend on each other, right? So formally, you're going after like some test. So typically, you do a significance test, a test that is like, now it can be even just like fitting a line. You get your coefficient, and the coefficient has error bars. So you do a t-test on that, and you get like a p-value out of it. If the p-value is above or below a threshold, you conclude that there is independence or not. Okay, let's say that you did this exercise, and you say they're unconditionally independent. So unconditionally means that in this regression where I checked whether the coefficient was significant, I only included the other variable. I didn't control for C, right? Well, at that point, if they're unconditionally independent, they cannot be parent and child, okay, because of the faithfulness. So essentially, if they were parent and child, so if there were a causal relation, the fact that that causal relation doesn't show up in a dependence would be fine-tuning. So you would need something else that cancels that causal relation perfectly, right? For instance, you could have a situation where two people are pulling on a rope and there is something in the middle. And every time I see that guy pulling, I pull stronger because I want the thing to be sitting in the middle. So we like compensate each other. And then there is no relation between the position of the object in the middle and my strength of pulling, just because it's canceled out by the other guy. But this is fine-tuning, because it means either there is a feedback system that ensures that we keep on pulling at the right strength, or you have set the initial conditions of the system so that these two things like completely allied. We say that, no, we don't want this. If there is some sort of, if there is independence, then it's because they're not parent and child. They are not cause and effect. Okay? Yeah.
In the last column, you have A points to B points to C.
I knew this would happen. A points to B. Oh, yeah.
So just wondering if you would sort of comment, like, if the idea is we only want to entertain those causal structures where the independencies or consequences of the causal structure.
I should have cut it off. Yeah.
Where it's a transit.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, I shouldn't have done this, right? Anyway, I'll skip over this. But you get the idea, right? So essentially, we can kill the dogs we don't like based on these assumptions. And so the black cat didn't work, like they weren't sleeping. Then we come to score-based systems, like of causal discovery. What you have is like that. Here you want to enumerate all the DAGs and score them. So that's a pretty general approach. A way to do that is that once you have a DAG like this, let's say that you have two variables, right? You have two variables, A and B. So that means, and it's telling you that A causes B. Let's say that then the probability, the joint probability distribution is going to factorize something like this. P of B given A, P of A. If you do this thing, and you have a form for this, so you know how in an alternative notation you can write something like this. B is equal to a function of A and some residual noise. Then you can write the joint distribution as long as you know how F and epsilon look like. So if you do this game, you come up with a joint distribution. And under this joint distribution, you have your data. No? You have A and B. And then you can assign a likelihood to this thing, right? And implicitly, this assigns a likelihood to all the DAGs. You do this game over all the DAGs. The problem with this approach is that there are lots of DAGs. So it goes up very, very quickly, the number of DAGs you can have For even like 7 variables, we have a billion possible DAGs. So computationally, we cannot do this efficiently unless we find very good ways to do it, which I will cover later. So coming to our problem, to the juice of the talk, what I wanted to do and why I'm using this stuff. The idea is that there's a bunch of objects up there in the sky. They're called galaxies. They usually have sometimes they have a black hole, a big black hole, a supermassive black hole in there. And they have properties that are related to each other based on scaling relations. Right. So are these scaling relations causal? Can we interpret them causally? Is there any debate about the direction of causality in the literature? Yes, there is. And what would happen if we throw a bunch of variables into this machinery and see if it can tell us something about that debate and other stuff that we didn't think about, maybe? Well, that's what we did. So this is a data set that we have, thanks to Ben, the guy in New York University. So we have about 100 galaxies that, unfortunately, I have to go into the details a little bit, because they are 35 are ellipticals, 38 are lenticulars, and 28 are spirals. You will say, why does it matter? I'll tell you why. So there are different morphologies of galaxies across the sample. And sorry?
What is the second
thing? It's lenticular. I'll show you. There we go. So I'll skip to this one. So this is called a Hubble tuning fork. It's this is done with the Galaxy Zoo data. Galaxy Zoo was a nice initiative where they went through SDSS images with citizen science, and people were classifying the galaxies by hand. So now they're using it to train machine learning models and stuff. So here they made the Hubble fork using SDSS images picked out from the Galaxy Zoo. And here on this side, you have ellipticals, right? So they're big, red, and dead, they're called, because they don't have much gas or at all. So they're not having star formation. The stars are all very old, typically. And they're reddish in color because of this. And the motions of the stars in ellipticals are typically pressure supported. So it's random motion. It's not organized like in a spiral. In spiral galaxies, unbarred or barred, so maybe I can use this thing now, it doesn't matter. We put them all into the same bucket because we didn't have many spirals. So unbarred or barred doesn't matter, right? But they're spirals. Spirals means that they are disk galaxies, first of all, like our galaxy. So they are dynamically cold. There is motion that is organized. They have angular momentum, but there is much variation around this plane, right? They don't bounce around too much. And they have more gas, so they can do more star formation. They have bluer colors, younger stars, okay? And they're all much smaller in mass than the ellipticals. So it's sort of two extremes. And what we think, I guess the consensus is that these guys, the ellipticals, are formed throughout cosmic evolution by mergers of these guys, of smaller things, right? And through the mergers, you trigger more star formation, you deplete the gas, and you destroy the order of the motions, and you get this cloud of stars with a bigger mass, right? Great. Lenticulars are not really fully, completely understood, like many things in astronomy, but they're sort of in between, right? So they're bigger in mass, they're still and that's important for what follows. So after having covered this, so now the white cat sleeps, let me go back. So for these galaxies, we measured 7 variables. Why 7 and not 200? Well, we do have 200 variables, but I don't want to throw them into a causal discovery algorithm because it's going to take forever, especially the one, the score-based method. So we selected, using subject matter knowledge, 7 variables. So the mass of the black hole, obviously, because that's what we care about, whether it's causing something to the galaxy, or the galaxy is determining its mass. And these three things, which we used to select the galaxies to a point, they are like the fundamental plane variables. So the central velocity dispersion of stars, the standard deviation of the motion of the velocity of stars along a line of sight, let's say, to keep it simple. The effective or half-light radius of the spheroid, so the part of the galaxy that is spheroid-like. So even spirals in the middle tend to have some like disordered motion. It's called a spheroid. So that one will have an effective radius. And then you can measure the density of mass within that radius. So to give you a sense of the scale, typically the black hole masses, they can be 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10, 10 to the 11 solar masses, something like that. The half-light radius is stuff in the kiloparsecs, at the very least. And then on top of this, we get the colors. So you can have as many colors as you want, like light is a spectrum. But here we use Wise, so we got like just one color. We stuck with one color. It's a difference between how much light you get in this band and in that band, right? The total stellar mass and the star formation rate, because the star formation rate is something that is very salient in the sense that for us, if there is gas, you form stars. If there's no gas, you don't form stars. But the black hole can have feedback on the gas, can remove the gas or heat up the gas, hinder star formation, and so on. So there, it's all part of the game. So with this data, which I plotted here for you, and you can see them in this pair plot, and they are color-coded by what kind of galaxy it is. So elliptical, lenticular, or spiral. So you got the three colors, right? Well, it doesn't tell you much, but if you look at it for a month or so, it's going to tell you a lot.
So still, how do you select lenticulars from ellipticals? What's the difference in selection? The mass or the color or what?
I think it's been used like the morphology. It's been done like separately from a catalog.
But what morphology? I mean, do they have some remnants of spirals or what?
No, the lenticular shouldn't.
On your figure, it is just the same, like, as elliptical.
To you, it looks the same. Let me see. But it's much smaller in mass.
Okay, so the mass was the selection.
Yeah, like in this case, this particular case that I'm showing you, like it was, people were trained to actually select them by looking at the shapes. So it's all of those things.
For these, or do you also have things like spectra for the galaxy?
Yeah, there is lots of stuff. Like if you want to have the mass of the black hole,
yeah,
typically you need lots of other measurements.
So if these S zeros are like disks but without spiral arms, perhaps you could just use the spectra to see if there's ordered rotation.
Yeah. I mean, I have some backup slides on the data if you want. And like this was done like by the New York NYU Abu Dhabi people. So like maybe we can talk about this with them later or something.
Clarification. In Galaxy Zoo, when this classification was happening, like citizen scientists were just looking at morphology. They didn't have access to spectrum, mass, things like that. They were just asked, look at these and classify them as spiral, elliptical, lenticular.
When I participated in Galaxy Zoo, it was like that. Nobody gave me spectra or anything. I don't know if they changed it more recently, but... Yeah.
There's some morphological aspects that trigger the lenticular.
Yeah. Like you would do like a training run, like they were telling you, like, this is a lenticular, this is a spiral or whatever. Yeah. And you would like keep on classifying. It was fun. And anyway, so two things I want to concentrate about here, like that we cared about, but that there's more things, but one is the fundamental plane, and the other one is the mass black hole sigma relation. So how am I doing with the time? Is it too late already?
Yeah. No, I mean,
somebody will take the room. It's okay. Yeah, so I'll try to skip a bit. So like the fundamental plane is this thing. It's basically the virial theorem. So if you have a galaxy, you can like guesstimate its potential, its binding energy, it's going to be proportional to some scale mass divided by some scale radius, some scale mass squared divided by some scale radius, right? And the kinetic energy also is going to be proportional to the mass and the velocity dispersion, which is giving you like squared, which is giving you like a temperature measurement. Right, great. So in virial equilibrium, which is what, well, you can prove that an isolated galaxy should follow this thing, this equation, you get the two to balance like this. So there is a constant times the kinetic energy plus the potential energy is going to be equal to zero. Hence, you have this relation here. So essentially, the velocity dispersion of stars, any scale velocity dispersion, like any scale velocity in the center. So for us, the velocity dispersion of stars within like half a kiloparsec from the center squared is going to be proportional to the ratio between mass and the radius. Great. Good. Of course, you can express it in different...
So this mass here, you take the total stellar mass of the galaxy estimate, or it's the mass of the central spheroid?
Okay, for the ellipticals, there is no difference.
Right.
For the spirals, people usually don't do this, but we are taking the central spheroid, yeah. Because otherwise...
It makes more sense.
Yeah. And so you can complicate this if you like, because you like weird units. For instance, you can introduce something that is proportional to this the log of the surface density, and you write something like this that people call the fundamental plane. It's fundamental. So it's a plane because we pass through the logs. So we're in log space. You ever wonder why we have so many power law relations in astronomy? Because people use logs, because the variables are very spread out over orders of magnitudes, and then they do linear regressions, and so we get a power law. I guess there's more to it than that. Another thing is the mass black hole sigma relation. And this has been around since the 2000s. So we have that the black hole mass at the center of the galaxy scales with the power law with the velocity dispersion. And like the velocity dispersion is calculated on stars that are not immediately affected by the black hole. So what is like interesting is that nonetheless, there is a very tight relation between these two. So somehow they talk to each other, or someone else talked to both of them, you know? So here we have a plot from a recent paper, Sahu et al., which is a collaborator of Ben, showing a relation like this holding over orders of magnitude in velocity dispersion. And the interesting thing about this relation is that there's lots of physics behind it. Like it's dirty physics in the sense that you need to simulate complex stuff. In particular, if you think that there is some sort of interaction between the black hole and the stars mediated by something else, possibly in the past, you still have to connect somehow two very different scales. So the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole is very small. Like the sun is, like 1.5 kilometers. And multiply that by 10 to the power of 10, it's still pretty small. And these stars are spread out within like half a parsec. So how do they talk to each other? Well, you can make simulations of gas falling into the black hole, being heated up, being kicked out. These are active galactic nuclei, AGNs. And then what happens to the gas when it hits the other gas that was sitting there, and so on. And this is all subgrid physics. So what I mean by subgrid is that if you run a simulation, like one of those that they're running in Abu Dhabi, even the zoom-in simulations will not be able to resolve this, not even close. And so you need to put in something by hand. So you need to separately model this physics locally and stick it in terms of some relations, some knobs that you can turn. So it's natural to think that the knobs you can turn are the causes and what you see is the effect. But who knows? And there is some debate in the literature about this. So what we're going to do is like look at these two specifically. So what did we do with this data set? Here come in like two other collaborators, Tristan and Joshua from Mila. So in the 2020, Joshua Benjo developed a thing called the GFlownet. I will not pretend that I understand how it works inside, but what it does is essentially efficiently sampling from a space, a discrete space, like that of the DAGs, in high dimension. And the problem we had with some problems that people had with score-based causal discovery were related to the fact that the size of the DAG space is enormous, and you have to evaluate them all. So in fact, this is solved by a kind of reinforcement learning approach, where you have an agent that is moving around this space, and it's essentially returning you a DAG with the probability that is proportional to the score, to how good we evaluated it. So this has been applied, and there is a paper by Tristan on DAG GFN, which showed that it does better than other like more naive or time-tested approaches. And we applied it to our data set. And from this, this allows us to sample some DAGs that are highly likely in terms of explaining our observed data. So here is like, this is a very fresh result. So here we have, probably this is the main slide, so there are no cats here.
So before showing, you know, the application to the actual data.
Yeah.
You also mentioned simulations. You know, so if you apply this to the simulated.
We're doing that.
We're
doing that. Yeah, but we're not done yet.
Okay.
Yeah, of course. Like, what you want is like the nice thing to have would be that in the simulation I can like tune the knobs. So those are the causes. I get the effects, and right, I want to recover what I know that I put in the simulation.
Okay, but that hasn't happened yet.
Didn't happen yet, yeah. Because paradoxically, it was easier to get the data immediately. We were more eager to jump to the data. But yeah, we will do that. So, okay, here, on this data set, we're looking at, remember, there's like three groups of galaxies, ellipticals, lenticulars, and spirals, and we treated them separately. So here you have the unique DAGs, like unique in the sense that they are different, but they can have been, they have been sampled multiple times. We sampled 100,000 DAGs from the GFlownet on the space of all possible DAGs, which is this size. This is like a long number. Yeah. Okay, still, within these 100,000 DAGs, we can sample more, but it takes more time. I think there is some sampling for 1 million running right now. Okay, well, the cool thing is that we get, for the ellipticals, out of 10 to the 5, we get 800, which seems a small number, but it's pretty big in comparison, that are all the same, right? And then we get some 800 that are very similar, and then on and on, we get more, less and less DAGs. But the DAGs that are more frequent look like each other. So we have a distance on the DAGs, this SHD, which is basically an edit distance, like what do you need to change to move from a DAG to another, like with words, you know? Pair, bear, I change one word. Pair, cosmology, I change lots of letters, right? So that's the same idea. Here you have that basically, it's reported on this scale here. Basically, the DAGs that are most frequently picked for ellipticals, they're all pretty similar. So you need to change one thing or two to move from the most frequent to the second most frequent. And this applies also to lenticulars and to a lesser extent and to spirals. So it looks like that essentially we got, yeah.
So here you are under the assumption that you got causal sufficiency, right?
Yeah.
Like you don't have any variables.
Yeah.
And the seven variables that you chose, they are
everything that. It's a very strong assumption. True. But we did something about that. Okay. So, well, this looks interesting. And why I think the take-home messages from this plot are that the posterior, which is the likelihood because we chose a flat prior on the DAGs, is pretty peaked on something. So the method is telling us, look, this is the causal structure. Or you can change an arrow or two, but not too much. And in fact, the other DAGs that look like the first, the most frequent one, are Markov equivalent to it, for the people who know what this means. So they are indistinguishable based on constraints. So that's a nice check, right? Great. So let's look at them. Do you see them? Because if you don't, I can zoom in. Okay. These are the two most frequent DAGs for elliptical galaxies. This guy is the massive black hole. So M with the little black dot on the bottom is a massive black hole. It turns out that we have found I said 800, it was 780. In the vast majority of the cases, comparatively, because there are many DAGs, right, that the velocity dispersion is causing the massive black hole, that the total stellar mass is causing the massive black hole, and star formation rate is causing the massive black hole. This is in the ellipticals, right? And then you get similar structures here, like that's what I was saying before, like here, essentially, this arrow changed direction, but it doesn't really matter for the rest. The rest of the DAG is the same. Great. Yes?
In the beginning, you said you don't want loops in this causal.
Do you see loops here?
No, I'm
sorry. Okay. I would be very scared if there was a loop.
But in reality, some phenomena can be, you know, back and forth.
That's true.
They affect each other in a way that sort of represent a loop.
Yeah. That's a possibility. We're thinking about it really hard right now. So maybe I need some people's input on this, because there are different ways to do causal discovery in the presence of loops. So that there is a notion of this separation that can be substituted by a thing called sigma separation. And there is some, like, we can do that. We can hurt ourselves while doing that, I guess. Or we could stick with simple stuff at first, because this is the first application to astronomy after all. So I don't know. But it's a very valid point. Yeah. So the cool thing is that you look at ellipticals and massive black hole seems to be a child. So if you look at this child, I mean causal child, right? Look at the other DAGs, it's almost always like that. Sometimes here it's also apparent, but this is much less frequent. Here. So, well, then you move on and you say, okay, let's look at lenticulars, which remember they should be in between spirals and ellipticals. And there you go. Sometimes it's a child like this. Sigma determines the mass of black hole. Here. Sometimes it's not. It's the other way around. Sometimes it's the other way around, okay? Then you move to spirals. Well, this was the zoom in for the people who couldn't see before. You move to spirals, you have the opposite picture. So massive black hole seems to be apparent to everything, like the cause of everything in spirals. Let's zoom in on the first two. So you have the massive black hole is like causing everything in the galaxy. Right? And here it's not so much like here, but it's still causing lots of stuff. So the question is like, what is going on? Like, let's look at all the DAGs together. Let's look at a thing called edge marginals. So how do you build this? It's like a matrix where for every dog, you have a 1 when there is directed edge and a 0 when there is not. And you take all the dogs and you take the average all of them, over all of them, right? All of the dogs that we sampled. So here it means that in 77% of our dogs, the velocity dispersion was causing the black hole mass. These are elliptical galaxies. And only 20% was the reverse causal relation. So that's saying, like, well, it seems that causality is flowing from the velocity dispersion to the mass of black hole in ellipticals. And you wonder why these two don't sum to 100 or to 1. I was wondering that. So 77 plus 20 doesn't total 100. It's because in some dogs, they are independent. They're not connected. But it's a minority of the dogs. Remember that we are sampling like proportionally to the likelihood. So some dogs are very unlikely, but still made it to the final sample. OK, then we got the lenticulars, and it's 50-50. So this edge between black hole and velocity dispersion can either go this way or that way. Enough of the dogs points one way, enough of the dogs point the opposite way. In spiral galaxies, it's the reverse situation. 67% is pointing from the black hole mass to the velocity dispersion, 18% the other way. So as with like the morphology gradient, the causality gradient goes together with that. Like we have three things that are like in a sequence, and they behave regarding this relation in a similar way. Then we can look here also at the fundamental plane. So remember the fundamental plane was connection between a bunch of variables here. So it's telling you that the velocity dispersion, the density, and the half light radius should be connected by something like this. And if you go here, let's look at ellipticals, because that's where the fundamental plane is actually used. Velocity dispersion, indeed, it's linked with these two other guys, but typically through the total stellar mass. To me, this makes sense, because after all, the causal thing, like what is set at the beginning, you know, you have a dark matter halo, and how much variance you get in there, it's because of the mass of that halo, right? And then you can think, like, I drop more gas and stars in there, and the radius will adjust.
So you have this flipping where the causality between color and star formation can flip between two DAGs that are comparably likely.
Yeah.
Is one interpretation of that that there's a hidden variable that drives both?
Yeah, I'll come to that now. So we have a physical interpretation, and I think you can imagine it in terms of a hidden variable, depending on what you declare to be a variable. I'm coming to that actually. Like, what? I'll go back to this later. So what could be the physical interpretation of this stuff we're seeing? So first of all, We notice that there is like a gradient in this, and it's like going well with the gradient in morphology. So maybe we're looking at something real here. And an idea that we had to explain this is that, as I was mentioning before, ellipticals have more gas. So if you want a feedback from the black hole to the rest of the galaxy, it's going to be through the gas, because interactions with stars are very infrequent. If you don't have gas in an elliptical, probably the black hole cannot talk to the galaxy, right? And on the other hand, ellipticals are made by mergers. So if you merge many galaxies, like in the picture here, many spirals to make an elliptical, what matters at the merger time is the properties of the galaxies that are merging, not of their black hole. So the black hole is small. If I have a car accident and I have a lighter in my pocket, it doesn't really affect the dynamics of the car accident, right? It's the same thing. So I can see why the causality would be flowing from the galaxy properties to the black hole for ellipticals, because it's like telling you it's the merging process, which could be considered a hidden variable, that is determining both. Or through the merging process, so then it's a mediator, you get this link. On the other hand, in spirals, I can see why the gas could be, we're not observing, we have a variable for the gas, but we're not using it here. It's more like hard to pin down. The gas could be like the reason why the black hole is affecting the galaxy in spirals. And the cool thing is that this is new, like breaking down this law on morphology of galaxies and thinking in these terms, like even if eventually the causality thing is going to be called into question later on, it like made us think about something that could be valuable down the line. So talking about like unseen variables, there's birds. So to validate this thing, this nice new GFlowNet thing, we use some more time-tested approaches. So, for instance, the PC algorithm. The PC algorithm is probably one of the oldest ways to deal with causal discovery. It's a constraint-based algorithm. And we applied it to the same data set. And look what we get. Very similar results. So we get the black hole mass is caused by the same three things. So this is exactly the same DAG that is most frequent in the GFlowNet exercise. We get something like in the middle. And here we get, well, it doesn't tell us much. So the thing is that the PC algorithm will learn a Markov equivalence class of DAGs. So you can imagine that there's a bunch of DAGs encoded by these things. Some of them have an arrow point in here, so you can complete this with an arrow point in there, or an arrow point in the opposite way. So it's like more than one DAG. But the point is that, at least in this case, it's like really confirming what we find with the GFlowNet over all possible DAGs. And we also used another constraint-based method, which is called FCI, fast causal inference. And this one is allowing for unseen confounds. And it's using like this notation for the graph. So there are no longer just like directed edges, but you can have bidirected edges, which mean there is a confound in between. Or you can have edges where it refuses to decide whether to put an arrow or not, and there is this little empty dot. So you can complete it either with an arrow or with no arrow. And here it's showing something similar for the black hole mass. And in particular, what we can say is that you can rule out black hole mass causing the velocity dispersion for ellipticals. But it could be a confound. So you cannot really rule out a confound here if you don't assume causal sufficiency. And on the other hand, it's showing that it's really convinced that the black hole mass and the star formation rate are confounded. So there must be something else. And my idea is that that could be the gas. So if we could measure the gas, then that would be the confounder. You've seen in these tests, in PC and FCI, that there is a little note up there. It says alpha equals 1.5. It's because, as I was saying before, we have finite data, so we do statistical testing. It's like more of a frequentist idea than the score-based approach. And this statistical testing, it requires you to set a threshold to throw away or to keep the null hypothesis of independence. And damned if you do and damned if you don't, because this threshold is going to determine, if I go to the backup slides here, based on the threshold, you get a certain rate of type 1 errors, where you see a correlation that is not there, or vice versa, or type 2 errors. And there is no way to save yourself. If you have many variables, you're doing lots of tests. At least some of those tests will be wrong. So this is something.
How this scatter in the relationship? In any of these tests, you have operations for the exploration between ellipticals, sparse and particulars, of the causality, but then you should also have a prediction about, or some information about the scatter. So, for instance, do you see the scatter in the Jensen relation for ellipticals different than in spirals? Is it bigger or smaller?
Yeah, that's more a question for Ben, actually, but. In you mean which relation?
Because this relation has scattered. Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So you found a different possible relationship in ellipticals and spirals.
Yeah.
So then I would maybe assume that the scatter in the relationship should be different.
Could be.
In fact, the
score based causal discovery uses all the data, so it's not just using the constraints of the independence. So it can use this stuff. In principle, because, I mean, when we think about it, I guess you would like to argue that if the scatter is different, then it shows that the mechanism is different, right?
Exactly. Uh-huh. Then the scatter is different, I guess, and then is the scatter for lenticulars in between the scatter?
Oh, I didn't check, but that's a great question, yeah. We should check that. So the scatter, like, by the way, you can measure it in two ways, right? Like, along the x-axis or the y-axis.
Yeah.
So. And so typically it's more natural to think of the cause in the x-axis and the effect in the y-axis. So that's why our stuff may be relevant even to people who are just like poring over these graphs and doing the usual thing.
Yes.
But yeah, let's talk about that. That's a great idea, to look into the scatters. I'm sure it's there in the papers by Ben, because it's been like dissecting these relations quite a lot. Now it's time, right?
I'll talk to you about that as well. Well, I don't want to interrupt your talk, so.
I'm done. I think I'm done, right? Oh, okay. On top of, well, I was like talking about the fundamental plane. So instead of the edge marginals, you can look at path marginals. So you do the same thing as with edges, but this time you put a one every time like something is connected even through intermediate steps to something else. And we get a similar picture. Interestingly, we really do get the fundamental plane now. So remember, the fundamental plane is like sigma e, sigma zero, but small sigma. Wow, great choice of variables. Re. So these guys are like pretty well connected in ellipticals. You see that there's like white cells here if you look at the path marginal. So that's telling us that, like in these DAGs, the ones for the ellipticals, even though like often the mass of the galaxies in between, if you look at the whole path, these guys are always connected, like these 1, 2, and 3. As you would expect, because that's the scaling relation, right? So, yeah, that was like a check that we were actually doing things right. And last thing, yeah. Well, no, I'm done. You know, sometimes you get surprised by your own talk. I think that the most important element at this stage is that we are bringing this technique to astronomy, because there are reasons why it's not been done before. I've been thinking about this for a few years, and I think the reason is like what here I wrote, philosophical qualms. It's like that. Before using a technique, you really need to figure out if it's like the right thing to do, right? Now, you can go ahead and do stuff anyway, but if you care about rigor in a way, you want to know that what you get out of this thing makes sense. So there's a bunch of like issues with applying this right away to astronomical data. Like one thing I would like to show with the blackboard is that But we don't have it in this data set because like we weeded out the variables. But let's say that you have a galaxy that looks like this. It doesn't look like this in the sky. In the sky, it looks like this, right? So what I mean by this is that while this thing has clear boundaries, so it's an object. An object is like a part of our perception that we single out and define as standing there, right? In a galaxy, it's a bit harder because you have this picture and you have to draw a boundary, right, around it at some point. So let's say that you come up with this half mass radius, but why not a 90% radius? So this is the radius that contains half of the mass in projection of the galaxy or of the light. And this is the radius that contains 90%. Of course, they're going to correlate, right? And this correlation, if you just were to blindly throw it into like a causal discovery thing, probably, I mean, remember that if A correlates with B, then either A causes B or B causes A or C causes A and B. And I'm not comfortable with any of these in this case because these two things are basically a function that we're integrating either to 50% or to 90%. And they correlate by construction in a sense. So there are a bunch of issues like this that you have like to like smooth them out in your mind before actually having the courage to apply this stuff to astronomy. So that's, I think that's the reason why we didn't get this done before, like a few years before.
So what makes you not able to put that into the system and marginalize over, like a free parameter choice?
What do you mean marginalize over here?
At a small, like, you know, additional parameter that varies over the range. In cosmology, we usually have these, like, traditional parameters that we marginalize over.
Yeah, no, I mean, let me see if I'm getting this right. Like, by marginalize over, I mean, like, you're integrating over it, right? Like,
I guess, like, last plot you've shown.
Not this one.
Last one with the tables. Okay, so maybe I misinterpreted.
I don't know which one it was, like, which one was
the... You have some posterior here.
Ah, like this one. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, this is posterior over the dogs. So...
Yeah, maybe we can discuss later.
What is difficult for me here is whether I should treat it as a different variable or not. And I can throw them both in. I'm going to get some error between them. I can disregard that, but why? Like, you know? So that's something that we were talking about during lunch yesterday as well. And this is one example, but it's all over the place in astronomy because very often, like, people define, let's say there is a thing called the relaxation time, right? And the relaxation time is like a formula that depends on the mass, the density, the velocity, this kind of stuff. And people list it as a property of the galaxy separately from those things. But then, like, it correlates with those things because you defined it like that. Yeah. So, you know, like, there's a bunch of things. That's why it took us a while to come up with these seven variables. So it's like, you know, when sculptures can work with bronze or with marble, and then with marble it's harder because you have to remove stuff rather than putting it in. And it's the same thing here. Like, you probably first have to remove the variables, and then, like, with subject matter knowledge, and then you can go all in with this machinery of causal inference. But yeah.
Well, since you've gone through all the slides, why don't we actually stop here? Because we do have a 1 p.m. seminar. For the people who are still interested, we can, of course, reconvene at 2 p.m. in the room to be
discussed.
Yeah. Okay, great. So why don't we stop here for lunch, and then at 2 p.m. let's reconvene, just continue the discussions. Okay, yeah, thanks again.
Thank you.